September 2nd, 2010, a man sends an email. He writes, and I'm quoting, I'm reading directly from the Department of Justice files, and I just had the most senior meeting JPM has had, save for Jamie, meeting with Wang Shishan. I spent almost 2 hours with Minister Li Wanchao of the organization department. JPM is JP Morgan Chase, the largest bank in the United States. Wang Shishan was China's top financial overseer. He later became vice president of China. Li Wanchao ran the organization department of the Chinese Communist Party, the office that decides every senior appointment in China's government, military, and state-owned enterprises. Now, the email was sent by Jess Daly, one of the most powerful bankers in the world, but he didn't send it to his CEO. He didn't send it to JP Morgan's board of directors. He sent it to Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted sex offender who had just finished a 13-month prison sentence for procuring an underage girl for prostitution. And Staley, he wasn't just updating Epstein. He was reporting to him because it was Epstein who told him how to get those meetings in the first place. Now, a lot of people, they hear Epstein and they think about the island. They think about the victims, and they should. More than 1,000 people were subjected to sexual violence by this network. But here's what most people haven't asked. Why? Why would a financial operation of this magnitude, that's brokering access between Wall Street and the Chinese Communist Party, also traffic children? Because the trafficking wasn't separate from the operation. It was the operation. It was the glue. When you're running back channels between the world's largest bank and the highest levels of the Chinese Communist Party, when you're connecting British cabinet ministers to foreign business interests, when you're funding the development of digital currencies that could replace the US dollar, you need a guarantee that nobody talks about. Contracts, they don't work at this level. Non-disclosure agreements are meaningless when you're dealing with sovereign power and billions of dollars. But if every person in your network has participated in something that would destroy them, their career, their family, their freedom, if it ever became public, nobody talks, nobody leaves. You don't need loyalty, you have leverage. And that's not a theory. Intelligence agencies have documented this for decades. The Soviets called it kompromat, compromising material used to control assets. And multiple sources connected to the Epstein files, including former Israeli intelligence operative Ari Ben-Menashe, have stated that Epstein was connected to intelligence operations. The children weren't the point. They were the price of admission to a network where the most powerful people in the world could do business in secret and know that everyone else at the table was just as compromised as they were. And when Epstein became a liability? Well, he died in a federal jail cell, or at least that's what we've been told. The people at the top kept their clean records. Now, if you watched my last video about Toronto, about how kids as young as 15 years old are being used as disposable weapons by people with no criminal records who continue to stay invisible despite millions of dollars going to the police, well, you'll understand that this is the same structure. It's the same system. It's a different scale. Kids at the bottom used as tools, people at the top staying invisible, and a layer in between, the Epsteins, connecting it all, expendable when they're no longer useful. Now, I want to talk about something else. Now that you understand what the glue is, let me show you what it was holding together. Let's talk about the channels. In 2009, while under house arrest, Jeffrey Epstein sent Jess Staley a detailed memo on how JP Morgan should approach China. This wasn't a casual suggestion from a rich friend. Epstein used the specific term Guanxi, the system of relationship building that governs access to Chinese political power. He told Staley, to adopt a deliberately submissive posture with Chinese officials. He drafted specific language for Staley to use. I want to build relationships. I seek your advice. I have the greatest respect for your culture. This was an intelligence briefing disguised as business advice, and the person delivering it was a convicted felon with no official role at JP Morgan. 1 year later, Staley sends the email I basically read you at the beginning of this video. He's met with the two most senior financial officials in China, and he reports it to Epstein, not his board. But it goes further than that. Epstein's associate, David Stern, proposed setting up an investment office, quoting directly from the files, with no obvious link to China to the outside, but extremely China-focused, with an office in Beijing. And its purpose? Discrete asset management for Chinese billionaires and co-investments with Chinese state-owned enterprises. Now, a hidden pipeline, Wall Street to the CCP, that was run through a network of a man compromising the powerful with the bodies of children. And JP Morgan processed it, over $1 billion through Epstein's accounts, wire transfers to Russian banks, payments to women in Belarus, Turkmenistan, and Turkey. Their own compliance officers flagged it for years. Nothing happened. It wasn't just banking. In August 2015, Epstein sat at a dinner in Palo Alto at the same table as Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Peter Thiel. He donated $850,000 to MIT, with $525,000 going directly to the Digital Currency Initiative, which became the principal home for Bitcoin's core development after the Bitcoin Foundation collapsed. He proposed digital currencies for Mongolia and Dubai. He discussed zero interest rates and financial architecture with Peter Thiel, Larry Summers, and Steve Bannon. And just earlier in this month, Lord Peter Mendelssohn, one of the most powerful politicians in British history, was arrested in connection with emails showing him leaking sensitive political and market information to Epstein while serving in the UK cabinet. The Bureau reported that the through line connecting Mendelssohn, Staley, JP Morgan, and Beijing's party elite runs directly through Epstein. So what the Department of Justice files document is this: a compromised network held directly by the abuse of children that was simultaneously building secret financial channels between Wall Street and the Chinese Communist Party, funding digital currency infrastructure, and receiving intelligence from sitting government ministers. Now let me show you what was built on those channels. Let's talk about the digital weapon. While Epstein was building bridges into the CCP, China was building something else, a digital currency controlled by the state, designed to ultimately replace the US dollar when it comes to international trade. China's digital yuan has already processed 3.48 billion transactions, cumulative value over $2.3 trillion. On January 1st of this year, China upgraded it from digital cash to digital deposit money. Now, that's not a software update. That's a fundamental transformation that turns a payment app into the backbone of a new financial system. And they're not keeping it at home. China is building cross-border payment rails with Singapore, Thailand, Hong Kong, the UAE, Saudi Arabia. Their cross-border platform, Project Mbridge, has processed $55.49 billion with the digital yuan making up over 95% of the volume. The South China Morning Post reported that the digital yuan aims to erode the dominance of the US dollar in the global financial architecture. And China's not alone. The entire BRICS bloc, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, plus the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Ethiopia, Indonesia, and Iran, launched a pilot in October 2025 for something called the UNIT. The UNIT is a digital trade currency. It's backed by 40% physical gold and 60% BRICS currencies. The real, the yen, the rupee, the ruble, and the rand equally weighted. Its purpose? Settle trade without the US dollar. Forget American banks. Forget the SWIFT system that the West controls. Now, I want to be precise here. The unit is still a prototype. It hasn't been adopted by BRICS. I'm just telling you what's being built, not what's fully operational. But the gold buying is not a prototype, okay? Between 2020 and 2024, BRICS, central banks, they've purchased more than 50% of all the gold available in the entire world. China holds almost 2,300 tons. Russia holds almost 2,400 tons. They're moving out of dollars and they're moving into gold systematically. So what triggered this acceleration? Well, a decision made by a Canadian. And let me talk about the trigger. February of 2022, Russia invades Ukraine, and the Western world, it does something unprecedented. Not unprecedented as in unusual. Unprecedented as in this has never happened before in the history of modern finance. Not one world war, not in one World War I, not in World War II, and not during the Cold War. The G7 froze approximately $300 billion in Russian central bank reserves. And the person who led that charge was Canada's finance minister, Chrystia Freeland. Bill Browder, the financier and leading sanctions advocate, said publicly on Parliament Hill that Freeland was the one who came up with the idea of freezing Russia's central bank reserves, that she had the legal analysis prepared, that she convinced all of the allies that this was the right thing to do. Now, I'm not debating whether it was right or wrong. Russia invaded a sovereign nation. There were consequences, but consequences also have consequences. Now, when you demonstrate that $300 billion of a sovereign nation's money can disappear overnight, every country that isn't in the Western alliance gets the same message. Your money is not safe in our system. If you're China holding US Treasury bonds, you just watched it happen to Russia. If you're India, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, you're asking one question: could that happen to us? Now that's why BRICS started buying gold. That's why China accelerated the digital yen. That's why the unit exists. The freezing of Russian reserves didn't just punish Russia. It accelerated the dismantling of the dollar-based financial system that has governed global trade since 1945. And the woman who triggered it? In January 2026, Zelensky appointed her as his economic development advisor, organizing what's projected to be an $800 billion restructuring, while Canada has already committed $23.5 billion. She triggered a global financial earthquake, and now she's overseeing the rebuild. Meanwhile, the trade agreement between Canada and the United States comes up for mandatory review on July 1st, 2026. If the parties don't agree to extend it, a countdown to its expiration begins. Canada's most critical trade relationship in crisis. And our Prime Minister's response? He flies to Beijing. He flies to China. And let's talk about his five words, because this is where Canadians really need to wake up. Mark Carney, former governor of the Bank of Canada, former governor of the Bank of England, one of the most connected central bankers on the planet, now our prime minister, stands beside Xi Jinping in Beijing and says this: I believe the progress that we have made and the partnership sets us up well for the new world order. His words on camera in Beijing to the president of China. And he didn't walk it back. When journalists asked what he meant, he said he was talking about restructuring trade governance, financial and payments regulation, digital trade, climate finance, and his words, the future of the global financial system and of the renminbi. The renminbi, China's currency, the one being digitized into a $2.3 trillion system built to replace the dollar, he said, the global trading system is undergoing a fundamental change. This is happening fast. It's large. It's a rupture. It's not a transition. A rupture, not a transition. In the same visit, he slashed tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles from 100% to 6%, reversing a policy that Canada adopted in lockstep with the United States just months earlier. That's why I called it a pivot. Okay? Pierre Poilievre responded, Prime Minister Carney must explain how he has gone from saying that China was Canada's biggest security threat before the election to suddenly announcing a strategic partnership with Beijing after the election. And that's a fair question. And that's a question Canadians should be asking. But I have a bigger one. I have a bigger question for you. Let me tell you what I'm not going to do first. I'm not going to tell you that there's a grand conspiracy. I'm not going to invite that. I'm not going to tell you all these people sat in a room together. I don't know that, and I won't pretend to. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what's documented, and then I'm going to ask you a really important question. Canadian to Canadian. The Department of Justice files show that a compromise network held together by the trafficking and abuse of over 1,000 children was simultaneously building secret financial channels between Western banks and the Chinese Communist Party and funding digital currency infrastructure. People connected to that network are being arrested right now. China built a digital currency that's processed trillions of dollars. It's designed to erode and then replace the dollar in international trade. It's already being deployed across Asia and the Middle East. Canada's former finance minister triggered the freezing of $300 billion in Russian reserves, which accelerated the global move away from the dollar. And now she's in Kiev, advising on an $800 billion reconstruction. BRICS nations bought over half the world's gold and are piloting a gold-backed digital currency to trade without the dollar. Canada's trade agreement with the United States is up for review in 4 months. And our prime minister, a former central banker who was never, not once, given a public mandate to restructure global finance, stood in Beijing and called all of this a new world order. Every fact that I just gave you is sourced. The full list, I'm going to put it in the description of this video. I'm not asking you to trust me. I'm asking you to check. But here's my question. When was the Canadian public consulted about restructuring the global financial system with China? When were you told that freezing Russian reserves would trigger a chain reaction that's now reshaping how the entire world moves money? When did anyone ask you whether you wanted your country's economic future to be tied to Beijing instead of Washington? Because from where I'm sitting, as someone who works in finance, as someone who watches what happens to regular people when the people at the top make decisions without asking, it looks like the biggest decisions about our financial future and freedom are being made by people who were never elected to make them. Central bankers, intelligence intermediaries, political appointees in back channels held together by the worst crimes imaginable against the most vulnerable people on earth. And the only reason you're seeing any of this is because a dead man's emails got released by the Department of Justice. Now, I don't have all the answers, but I have the question. Who voted on this?